Okay, I want to call the meeting to order and want to welcome you to the Early Childhood Policy and Finance Committee. We have a new name this year, which is exciting. So we have the policy part that used to be a part of Representative Mariani's committee is now part of our committee. I thought first of all, we'll just start out by doing introductions. We are doing free seating this year where you can sit anywhere you want. Because we know it's late in the day, and you're kind of thinking, I have committee, and it's 4:30. So hopefully that'll give you a chance to mix it up a little and get to know different members and so forth. What we want to do is I'm going to start with the staff and do introductions. If you can say your name, what your responsibilities are. And in this committee, what we do is we do where you lived when you were 3 years old. And my intern, who is we'll introduce shortly, said, why don't we do and your favorite game when you were three or a child. So let's start with Daniel.
Madam Chair, I feel like I got put on the spot.
Oh, wow. Can you handle it?
I think okay, so. Sure. Danielle Lemire from House Research. I staff this committee and a couple other committees as well. And just as a reminder for everyone, House Research is available to all members of the House, and we provide bill drafting and amendment services and background research, and anything that we do for you is confidential. Where I lived when I was three, I was in Des Moines, Iowa. That's my hometown. And my favorite game was probably hide-and-seek when I was little.
I'm Sarah Benskofer. I'm the committee administrator for the committee, and I grew up in Austin, Minnesota. And my favorite game was probably Chutes and Ladders.
Chutes and Ladders, okay. And we'll go this way. I just want to say, Sarah, if they're absent or going to be late, they talk to you, right? Or they talk to Matthew. Okay.
Hi, I'm Matthew Colley. I'm the committee legislative assistant for the committee, so I keep the minutes. And if you're going to be absent, you can also talk to me. I lived in Northfield, Minnesota when I was three. My parents taught at St. Olaf at that time. And probably my favorite game was also hide-and-go-seek.
So. My name is Emily A. James. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee. Like House Research, we are nonpartisan staff, and so we do a lot of different legislative supportive services, mainly that have to do with money. So if you want to find money, cut money, whatever you want to do with money, I can do that for you. And when I was three, I lived in Denver, Colorado. And when I was a kid, I loved the night games, like Kick the Can, where you got to be out all night and playing games with the neighborhood kids. So.
Good. Well, thank you. Now we have a page. And introduce yourself. And
hi, everybody. I'm Kim Lewis. I'm a three page. I do whatever you guys need me to do. When I was three, I was in Woodstock, Illinois. Where I grew up, and she's been moved down on day to dress in my entire town. and my favorite game, Tally Who More, I would say, is Trivial Pursuit.
Okay. Wow. Is that Melva?
I am a VFL caucus research. My name is Melva Bradkey. When I was three, I was on a farm in Mount Carroll, Illinois. Mm-hmm. And my favorite game was watching my big brother do magic tricks.
Oh, interesting. Carmen?
I'm Carmen Carter, I'm a Republican research for this committee. When I was three, I was in Palmer, Alaska, where I grew up and graduated. And I think my favorite game was Colored Eggs, which is something our family played at family reunions.
Well, thank you. And I know, intern Lynn, do you want to stand up and introduce
yourself? I'm Lynn Heibel Hoskins. I'm interning with NORA this term. And when I was 3 years, I lived in Bloomington, and my favorite game was always kickball. We had the best kickball field all of the neighborhood in our backyard. Still can see the grass lines to this day.
And Lynn is a child care center director and getting her master's. I teach early childhood public policy. She's also one of my students. And now she's an intern, but you know what? She knows more about child care than I'll ever know. So she's a great resource for all of us. For the members, if you can talk about your other committees too, just so we can get a sense of what other committees you're on. So why don't we start with Mindy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I grew up in Rochester, Minnesota, and I sure don't remember what my favorite game was, but I like to play a lot of the ones that were listed here, so I'm just going to say hide and seek because I'm not sure. I like to play outside, though, and play games outside, and I had a lot of relatives that lived on the farm, and so we played a lot of make-believe, and that's probably was my favorite of all, I guess. I also serve on K-12 Education Finance, and I've always wanted to be on this committee because to me it should be E-12 working really closely together, so I'm thrilled to be on the committee. And I also have Finance and Education Policy, K-12 Education Policy.
Well, we are thrilled to have you on the committee, so welcome.
I am Tara Mack, and I was living in Burnsville when I was 3. And I think my favorite game was Slapjack. And the other committees I'm serving on are Labor and Consumer Division, Bioscience of the Workforce, Health Policy, and, I think that's all.
Okay, great. Thanks. There'll be a lot of cross-coordination. Our bill eventually splits into the, and joins with the K-12 Finance Bill, as well as with the Health and Human Services Finance Bill. Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Keith Downey from District 41A, which is Edina. That's actually where I was when I was 3, too. So I did spend a little bit of time outside the town, so I'm a little broader than that. But favorite game probably was Mousetrap.
Oh,
I've been a little advanced for age 3, but that's what I remember. In terms of other committees, pleased to be on 3 education committees, this one, K-12 policy, and higher ed and workforce, so I kind of get to span the whole spectrum, which is really great. Taxes and state government finance.
And you are the Republican lead.
I'm the Republican lead.
So glad to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Nornes, you're back.
I'm back. Thank you for remembering.
We missed you.
Been on this committee from the beginning, I think.
Yes, you have.
Yeah. Representative Nornes, I was in Beltrami when I was 3, a little town, and it gets people confused because it's not located in Beltrami County. It's in Polk County. Set the record straight. Small town, I didn't have many kids to play with, so I kind of made up my own games, I guess. And baseball would be one of them that I played by myself.
Thank you, Lord.
I was always the winner, yeah. But actually, you throw the ball up on the roof and then you go catch it. That's the way you did that.
We did that, yeah.
So, and I serve on 3 committees, just like Keith, Education Policy, Higher Ed, and this one. And then on the Energy Committee.
Good.
That's it.
Thank you. Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Ward, when I was 3, I was living in Proctor, Minnesota, which is up by Duluth. We overlooked Duluth, is what we used to say up there. My favorite game was called Runaway. I would run away. So my parents put a harness on me, and I got out and ran away. So then they built the fence, and I climbed over, and I ran away, and I still love that game. My other committees are K-12 Finance and Public Safety Finance.
Madam Chair, Gail Kulik-Jackson from 16A. When I was 3, I was living on my parents' dairy farm. I'm one of 6 kids. That was in Todd County outside of Browerville, Minnesota. And we had a lot of ponds, and my favorite thing was to go out with the older brother and sister, and catch frogs.
Oh, fun.
Oh, and my other committees are Civil Justice, Public Safety, and Energy.
Representative Sandra Peterson, and I grew up in Benson, Minnesota, in western Minnesota, and the oldest, again, of 5 siblings, 6 of us. And my favorite game was, because we lived on a farm, we didn't have access to a lot of other children, so we would build these elaborate playhouses in the trees, especially in the summer, make schoolrooms and make mud kitchens with mud pies, and I always had an audience with 5 younger siblings. I was the oldest, and so they always kind of would chime in with whatever I wanted to do, and so it was really fun for most of the time. They remember I was a little bossy, so they still have a bit of a burr in their saddle about that. But anyway, it was a fun thing to do, especially in the summer months. And I serve on Health and Human Services Finance, K-12 Policy, and Rules and Administration.
Great. Thank you. And Representative Peterson is the co-chair of the Early Childhood Caucus. And we'll be talking about the summit in a little bit if you want to talk about that as well. I will say, I'm the chair of the committee. I grew up in Tucson, Arizona, and I'm a native and raised there all my life and went to college there. So I'm new to Minnesota, but my grandparents are from Benson, Minnesota, which I think is really funny. And we had this game in Tucson. They had searchlights at night. And so it was sort of like Runaway, but you would run away from the searchlights. And so we had this, because, you know, there's no daylight savings in the West, so it gets dark earlier. So that on the gravel, you would run. It's a little different. So, good. Let's go away. Representative Rosenthal.
Madam Chair, my name is Paul Rosenthal. I grew up in Scarsdale, New York. I can remember water for as young as I can remember. I think my parents threw me into the lake, either wanting to get rid of me or what could happen. But my favorite game was Marco Polo, and I also liked to play in the mud a lot. Any mud was good. I serve on transportation policy and oversight, public safety policy, and I'm the vice chair of this committee. I'm very excited about this because it's an issue that is very important to me, to the state, to our country, and just happy to be here.
Good. We thought we'd have you chair next time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We'll give you a few times.
I'm Carolyn Lane. I grew up in Hibbing, and first 3 or 4 years of life was in an apartment downtown above a dry cleaner. So it wasn't until I was 4 that we moved to a house and we had a big yard and a nice neighborhood. So at 3, I don't know. I probably just was envious of my older brother's toys, like trains and stuff.
I'm Representative David Bly, and I represent 25B, Northfield, Lonsdale, and Belle Plaine. And when I was 3, I was living in Northfield. I had I was born in Dubuque, Iowa, and we moved to Northfield shortly after just before I turned 3. Not when I was 3, but my favorite game was neighborhood softball that my father would organize, and it was great fun to see him in that role and play with him. So.
Fun. Good. Thank you. Well, Representative Hamilton, Representative Mariani, you probably caught on what we're doing.
I did.
Right. Okay. Representative Mariani can get it. We're doing, you have to say
a word or nothing.
Where you lived when you were 3 and your favorite game when you were little and your committees.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was hoping we could let Representative Mariani just try to figure it out as we went. That would have been entertaining. When I was 3, I lived in Dakota City, Iowa, a little town right next to Humboldt, Iowa. And it's interesting that you bring up the age of 3, because that's when my parents split up. And so I remember that vividly. However, the games, I loved playing outdoors. You talk about the mud and runaway and everything else. Absolutely. I love playing outside any chance that I could get. The committees that I serve on Ways and Means, Agriculture and Veterans Affairs, Finance and Policy, both of those, Environmental Finance, and this one as well.
So, good. New to the committee, so glad to have you. Good. Representative Mariani. The last for best. Let's see what you played when you were...
Three at a game?
Well, in 23, where did you live? And a childhood game that you, your favorite.
Oh, okay.
If you can remember.
Well, at age 3, oh boy, I'm not even sure. We moved around quite a bit, actually. My guess is we were living in Gary, Indiana at that time. My dad moved around following jobs from Michigan into Chicago, where we eventually... settled, so he worked in the steel mills in Gary. It was a really dirty, hazardous job.
Wow.
In games at that age?
Your childhood?
In my childhood? Well, it had to be street baseball. Everyone played baseball. You know, like nowadays everyone plays basketball. Well, in the 60s everyone played baseball. And so we used to... when I was a little bit older, we would, I grew up in Chicago, so we would go from, you always had to go in a group because it was not safe to go outside of your neighborhood by yourself. So we'd always go with a group and challenge some kids at another, school playground to a baseball game. And then the trick was to get out of there as quickly as possible after the last hitting back into your neighborhood. So, street ball. I serve on mostly education committees. This one, the K-12 finance. I chair the K-12 policy committee, and I also serve on ways and means. We haven't met for a while, and that's quite all right with me. So, anyway, look forward to working with you and with this committee. A very important agenda. I served on sort of our inaugural committee. You and I were on that together many years ago. We used to call it Baby Ed back then, and we did some really good work in the mid-late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be good to get back in the swing of good public policy for early childhood.
Well, glad to have you. I'm glad that you have two other chairs on my committee. That is something new for me. We're delighted to have you. And for the policy, I know policy had gone through your committee, Carlos, and we're happy to have it here because I think it for us, it'll help us kind of bring our picture more into focus. So we appreciate that as well. I'm going to make just a couple of ideas and introductory remarks, and then we do have the department that's going to testify today, Department of Education, in terms of what early ed counselor in their area. Fascinating to hear all your games. You never know, you learn a little bit about each person in what they said. So thank you for sharing, and hopefully we'll make this a lively committee at this time of day. The things I see as our role is one, is to look at the task, and the tasks for the committee are, I hope you will learn as much as possible. This is a very complicated committee. All your committees are probably complicated, but when we have both the Department of Education accounts and the Department of Human Services accounts, many of them are, some of them are forecasted accounts, they're formula accounts. It's a challenging area, so I hope for all of us one of our main tasks will be learning as much as we can. The other part, and you know this from the other committees, is to make policy and funding recommendations. Because this is a finance committee, our ultimate role here is to pass out a finance bill. This year, I hope, by having the other chairs on the committee and the structure has changed a little bit, that we will take this bill to the House floor as it is. In the past, last year, it went to the finance committee and split between the two other committees. So we didn't really get to get up on the floor and state our case. So I hope Chair Greiling will help support and make that come through, because then we can talk about early ed. And otherwise, when it goes under the education bill and under the Health and Human Services, it kind of gets buried under there. So this is our chance to highlight it, and we will be making those final funding recommendations. The third thing I think our task, and we're going to spend some time learning, is the value of early childhood education. Many of you know this, but we are going to bring Art Rolnick in to talk about his work in terms of the return on investment. We are going to bring in Arthur Reynolds, who did the preeminent study in the United States on the Chicago parent-child centers. We are going to have Richard Chase come in, who does the research, if you saw the Wilder study, he does that research on kids and what's happening with our youngest kids in Minnesota. So I think we have a good set of tasks, and I hope we'll go on this journey together and learn as much as we can and come out with a good bill. In terms of what I see as the three areas we'll probably be working on the most, the first is on quality issues. There is, for the Early Childhood Caucus, which is over 140 members, I would say it's almost 150 members now, you know, most of the new members have joined, they have endorsed a quality rating system bill. It's a very, I don't want to say a light bill, but it's right now it's a very interesting bill, so there's no money in it. So I hope you will all be open to it and think about it. It creates a framework for more quality in child care, especially. It takes the parent aware system that's being done in Minnesota right now, a star rating system for child cares, and potentially takes that statewide. And the author, chief author of the bill is Representative Peterson, and so she'll be having, well, the hearing on your bill.
And I hope everybody would fill out one of those little forms and sign on to it. We put it in very quickly because we wanted to be sure that we got it in that first round of bills that were introduced. But we hope you'll fill out a form and say you'd like to be on the bill.
Do you remember the House file number?
Yeah,
is it 40? It's 40. House file 40? Yeah. Because that's, yeah, having as many folks as possible and bipartisan as well. If we hope you'll take an interest in it. It's you will be learning a lot. We will also have overviews on the allowances and the scholarships that were funded, so we'll be talking a lot about quality. The second piece that we'll be working on is collaboration. The governor appointed an advisory council on early childhood, if you heard that, about a couple of weeks ago. They're going to be meeting in February. There are legislative members. I'm the the House member, Terrell Clark. Who is the House Republican? Yeah, I don't, if you're interested, they're looking for a House Republican for that. I don't think that's been appointed officially. And the minority leader will make that appointment. As well as, who are the other? Jeff Michelle, who's the other senator. So it's a bipartisan group that's going to be working and collaborating on the early childhood. Also, the business community is very involved, and so you'll be hearing more about that. And lastly, I think we kind of covered this, which is the history of early ed. As Carlos said, I think it was 98 was the first time there was a committee, and Rep. Sikora chaired that committee. And then
it
was it early?
Tony Kinkle.
Oh, and Tony Kinkle, that's right, was the first chair.
96?
Yeah, 96. I was elected in 96, so I think it was the 97th session, maybe? Uh-huh. And then, so it was in the House, and then if you recall, then it was not in the House, and the Senate picked up the Early Ed Committee. John Hottinger had that. And then now it's back in the House, but we do not have a Senate counterpart. That's the good and bad. The good thing is we get to hear the issues, air them out, talk about them. But ultimately, when we go to conference, we don't match up with them, and then they don't necessarily understand the issues to the degree we do. And then we're putting together our specific bill, and theirs might look quite different. So that's kind of our history and kind of where we've been. I'm delighted to be the chair. This is something I always wanted to do. We always wondered if we were going to be back in the majority. So we, even though it's been 2 years, we're still thrilled so far. I don't know about this year if we're actually all that thrilled with the majority, but I'm happy to be working on this issue. The last thing I want to talk about, and then we'll have the we'll do the rules, and then we'll have Emily start and talk a little bit about her fiscal analysis is, let's see, oh, the summit. January 28th, the Early Childhood Caucus is on board with doing the summit. What this is, the speaker opens up the chamber for one topic a year. Last year was energy. This year it's early childhood. David Lawrence, who's the publisher of the Miami Herald, former publisher, is coming in, and he is now an early childhood champion, works on this, helped pass a universal pre-K initiative in Florida, and then also helped fund it in the Miami area. So really dynamic speaker. He should be really interesting. The CEO of Wells Fargo Bank from Minnesota is going to be there, John Campbell, and he will also be speaking about business commitment to early childhood. And we have Jim Houlihan coming from Grand Rapids, so we have some rural presence, and he'll talk about his Invest Early initiative. So if you don't have it on your calendar, I hope you do, and we'll put it on there. It's 4 o'clock to 5:30 on Wednesday, January 28th. For the committees, we will be doing MDE and then DHS. We will be, as I said, hearing about some of the different initiatives. But the day after the summit, I wanted to let you know Louise Stoney is going to be here. She's a national financing expert that, frankly, kind of has been helping us put the QRS initiative together and has done that around the country. So I think that will be a big couple of days for early childhood. Let's see. I have to see if I did everything I'm supposed to do. Let me just make sure. You know to turn off your cell phones and pagers. I know this is a tough time, particularly if you have kids and if they're calling you. That's why I have mine here. If you ever see me do that, we know it's the time of day where it's going to intersect with your family potentially. Committee rule procedures are in your packet. Just look those over and try to get familiar with those. Our ultimate goal here is all kids school ready by 2020. And that was actually put in legislation last year. We'll be talking about the benchmarks and how we're going to get there. But that's ultimately what we want to do. And with that, we'll turn over to Ms. Adrian to do a fiscal overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, the document that I will reference, you should have in your folders. It looks like this. It's a spreadsheet. And before I really get into that, I talked a little bit about the fiscal staff, and you'll see a lot of us around, and please feel free to always ask us questions. We can help you, or else direct you to whomever should help you. We have a lot of documents on the website. Another document that's kind of interesting is this. It's called Financing Education in Minnesota, and Greg Crow is the other fiscal analyst for K-12, and he put this together, and it has some early education stuff in the back. So I can get you a copy of that. It's also, there's a link to it on our website. Before I get into our spreadsheet, I'll give you a little bit of the big picture context. This committee controls around $425 million of the general fund budget for the state. The total general fund spending for the whole state for the biennium amounts to about $36 billion. So the committee controls about 1% of that, just to kind of give you a broader context. And you've all heard a lot about the deficit. Unfortunately, the shortfall for the 2008 and 9 biennium is $426 million. In the following biennium, it gets worse when the shortfall will be $4.8 billion. We'll have a February forecast come after that. Some of the numbers might get worse. We've been told that they probably will get worse at that point. Not to put a downer on the first meeting and everything, but I just want you all to be aware of that, particularly with spending items, and just be aware that cuts will probably have to happen. And some important budget dates then to know about. The governor's budget with his recommendations will come out, we believe, on January 27th, and then the February forecast should be about February 27th. And then after that, leadership will administer targets at some point. So then we'll know if we have a zero budget to hit, if we have to make cuts, if we get spending, you know, however that'll work. But we'll talk about more of that as time goes on. Okay, so if you'll look at the spreadsheet, I'm not going to go through every single number and line item on here. Danielle will talk a little bit about each account that we have. I just kind of want to give you a sense of how to read it. We have, in this committee, as Representative Slavik was saying, we have the education accounts, and then we also have the Department of Human Services accounts. So the first big chunk is where it starts off with early childhood and family support. Those three areas, those are the education pieces that we have. And then below that, those are the Department of Human Services pieces that we have. If you look at the columns, the way that it's set up right now is we'll probably focus more on the 2010, 11, and 12 and 13, those two bienniums throughout this session, but I just wanted to give you a reference point, so I also included the 2008 and 9 biennium. Right now, these numbers in here are based on the November forecast. Once we get the governor's recommendations, I'll put those in the spreadsheet. And then when the February forecast, those numbers come out, I'll also include those. So it's going to get a lot bigger and a little bit trickier to read. Let me give you just a few examples to kind of show you how to read this. If you look at line 8, that shows you the Head Start program. And so you can see that the funding, that one is a pretty consistently funded program. So every year they get $20 million, $20.1 million. For that program. And then the biennium total, when we talk about that, you can see that that's $40.2 million. Another example I wanted to point out is basic sliding fee. That's on line 30. And those totals change a little bit more. One thing that's a little bit tricky, this is just general fund money here. So what you don't see on here are funding streams like federal funding, local funding, private funding. So a lot of these programs get money from other areas. So when you see numbers kind of go up and down, like basic sliding fee does, it might go down in certain years, but that a lot of times means that they had an increase in federal funding. So if anything just kind of seems confusing or you have a question, please feel free to ask me about it. I'm also going to point out the child care development line. That's on line 31 for the Health and Human Services area. That one for the 2010... the 2010, you'll see that it goes down to about $1.4 million in spending. That's the area that Representative Slavik was mentioning where we have the child care allowances and scholarships. Those were funded in there, but that's not an ongoing program at this point, so that's why that goes way down. And I think that's it. The other thing I wanted to mention was that the committee has jurisdiction over the general fund accounts here. There is also an exception there with federal funding, that TANF is one source of federal funding that the legislature has some control over. The only thing I want you to keep in mind, though, is something called maintenance of effort requirements that you have to make sure that you maintain. So it's not as simple as just taking TANF money and putting it towards something else. We can get more into that later also. And then I think that's about it. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Good job. It's good to get familiar with the spreadsheet up front, and we're going to obviously spend a lot of time with this. For those of you that are new to the committee, as Emily said, the like lines 2 through 8 are the early childhood family and family support, which is things like ECFE, school readiness, Head Start, things like that. And for if you didn't know, like lines 11 through 17, we do have community ed and prevention items in our committee. Again, all of community ed, so if your people are lobbying you on that and they know you sit on this committee, that would be one of the reasons they might want to talk with you. We also have the after-school learning grants on line 15, so you may hear from some after-school folks as well as school-age care on line 16. And then lines 19 through 23, the self-sufficiency, I see some of the lobbyists here from ABE. So adult basic ed, and as we know, most people are going to need to be educated with the economic downturn. Literacy grants and GED tests are also in there. So, and then the child care. So thank you. It's a good comprehensive overview of what's happening. Appreciate it. Next we have Danielle, who's going to talk about the research area and kind of some of the statistics. Does it count?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to go through and do a really brief overview of the programs that we have under the jurisdiction of the committee. Everyone should have a handout that looks like this in your packet, and that's basically what I'm going to be working off of. And I'm going to just do a really general overview of the programs because I know that both the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services staff will be coming in to do more detailed overviews than what I'm going to do here. And also, just for informational purposes, you also have in your packets an information brief that looks like this that will give you a lot more detail on the programs that I'm going to be talking about. So to go through just the little three-page handout, I've split this out so that I have the programs organized basically the same way that they are on the spreadsheet. So the first grouping of programs are the early childhood and family support programs. And ECFE, which is early childhood family education, is a program for children from birth to kindergarten, their parents, and expectant parents. Programs include parent education to promote children's learning and development, and they also may include an early childhood home visiting component to the program. And this program is funded through state appropriations, a local levy, and also participant fees. The school readiness program is a program to enable children to enter school with the necessary skills and behavior to succeed. In order to be eligible, a child must be at least 3 years old and have had a developmental screening. And school readiness is funded through state appropriations and participant fees. Health and developmental screening. School districts are required to provide a developmental screening for children before they start school. And students can be screened by a school district, a public or private health care provider, or an individual health care provider. And this is funded through a state appropriation. Next is the Educate Parents Partnership, which is something that the Department of Education coordinates. The department distributes informational material to the parents of newborns before they leave the hospital, and the information includes information about the ECFE program, child care resource and referral programs, and interagency early intervention committees, among other things. And this was also funded through a state appropriation. Next is the kindergarten entrance assessment, and this is something that is based on a kindergartner teacher's own assessment of 32 indicators, a sampling of entering kindergartners take the assessment, and it must be representative of the incoming kindergartners, and this is funded through a state appropriation. Head Start is a federal program designed to provide a comprehensive family-oriented program to improve the school readiness for children from low-income families. Head Start funds go to the community organizations that are federally designated as Head Start grantees, and this is funded primarily through federal funds, but the state also appropriates some funding as well. And then the final program under the Early Childhood and Family Support Programs is the Pre-Kindergarten Exploratory Project. These were established in 2007. It's a partnership with the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. There are three projects. One's in St. Paul, one's in Hennepin County, and I think the other one is in Seward.
These are better known as the allowances.
Right, yes. And the Pre-Kindergarten Exploratory Project, as Representative Swalwick said, are better known as the allowances. These are for low-income families to pay for their children's education in a quality early education program. And it's funded through a state appropriation, but I believe that's set to expire at the end of this fiscal year. Next are the community education and prevention programs. The first one is community education, which is intended to maximize the community's use of public schools and expand the involvement of community members who have skills or knowledge to share. Operated by school districts and participating districts can also offer youth services programs and other programs. It's funded through state aid, local levy, and participant fees. Next is the Adults with Disabilities program, which is offered through community education and can include outreach activities, classes specifically for adults with disabilities, services enabling the adults to participate in community education, and activities to increase public awareness and enhance the role of people with disabilities in the community. And this is funded through state aid, local levy, and funds from other public and private sources. Hearing impaired adults is the next program, and that provides services to adult students who are hearing impaired and meet certain other requirements. Support services can be provided for local school district adult education programs, adult technical college programs, and vocational education programs, and this is funded through a state appropriation. After-school community learning grants provide grants to various organizations that serve youth after school or during non-school hours, and programs are expected to increase school connectedness, academic achievement, the capacity of participants to become productive adults, and to prevent truancy and juvenile crime, and it's funded through a state appropriation. And I think this one may also be sunsetting at the end of this fiscal year. And the final program under community education and prevention is school-age care. This is offered by school districts for children from kindergarten through grade 6. Programs must provide supervised activities during non-school hours. School-age care revenue is appropriated for the additional cost of providing services to children with disabilities or children experiencing temporary family problems. It's funded through state aid, local levy, and participant fees. The next two programs are under the heading of self-sufficiency and lifelong learning, and that's adult basic education and GED tests. Adult basic education provides academic instruction for persons over age 16 who do not attend school. It enables students to obtain high school diplomas or equivalency certificates, and it's funded through federal funds, state appropriations, and participant fees. And then the GED test program reimburses testing centers for 60% of the cost of administering GED tests, up to a maximum of $40 per individual. GED tests are available to Minnesota residents over age 19, whether or not they have taken a refresher course, and this is funded with state appropriations. And then finally, we have the child care programs, which are administered by the Department of Human Services. The first one is the Minnesota Family Investment Program, or MFIP child care program, which subsidizes the child care costs of families receiving cash assistance through MFIP. It provides child care assistance for eligible families for the first 12 months after leaving MFIP cash assistance as well, which is called transition year child care. The maximum income limit in order to be eligible is 175% of the federal poverty guidelines at program entry, and then you can stay on the program up to 250% once you're on. Children up to age 13 are eligible for child care assistance. The MFIP child care assistance is a forecasted fully funded program, and it's funded through federal funds, state appropriations, county funds, and parent co-payments. The other child care assistance program is Basic Sliding Fee Child Care, which provides a child care subsidy to low-income working families who are not receiving cash assistance through MFIP. It has the same maximum income levels and age guidelines as the MFIP child care program does, but this is a capped allocation, so some counties have waiting lists for this program. And it's also funded through federal funds, state appropriations, county funds, and parent co-pays. Then there are child care development grants, which are distributed by the Department of Human Services to the child care resource and referral programs for child care services grants and family child care technical assistance grants. And these are funded through state appropriations and I believe also federal funds. And the last two programs, the school readiness service agreements, which I believe the department is now calling school readiness connections, allows the Department of Human Services to pay higher child care provider reimbursement rates for up to 50 child care providers that perform services that support school readiness for children and economic stability for parents. It's funded through a state appropriation, and I believe it sunsets at the end of this fiscal year.
Yeah.
And then the final program is a Family, Friend, and Neighbor grant, which promotes children's early literacy, healthy development, school readiness, and fosters community partnerships. Grants must be used to, among other things, provide training, support, and resources to family, friend, and neighbor caregivers to improve children's health, safety, nutrition, and school readiness, connect family, friend, and neighbor caregivers and children's families to early childhood screening programs, and provide family, friend, and neighbor caregivers and children's families with information about early learning guidelines. It's funded through a state appropriation, and this program also sunsets at the end of this fiscal year.
Great. Well, thank you. I think it's helpful. The reason we wanted to do this and we met ahead of time and talked about this is because it's complex. And so to sort of lay this out once, so at least when we get down the road, you're not saying, we do that? This committee covers that? This particular update, the Community Early Childhood and Adult Education Programs, which is also on the web, is, you know, good late-night reading, good understanding. It was very outdated. I don't think it had been updated for 5 years, maybe. So it's really up-to-date. And if you want to learn what's happening in this area in terms of funding, you saw the mix of funding. There's federal funding, state funding, aid, levy, all kinds of different ways that these are funded. I would like to ask the department to come up, and while they're coming up, I wanted to share with you that the current waiting list on basic sliding fee is at 6,140 kids are waiting, and I think in October it was 2008, 7,159. Is that right? So those are the kids and families that are out there needing the assistance, trying to get help with their child care and on a waiting list. Representative Downey?
Yeah, Madam Chair, if I might just ask a question of Ms. Adrian. Is there any place where you see kind of comprehensively the programs and the other funding sources than the state general fund side by side, so we'd have just a picture of what the relative state contribution is? And I appreciate fees and things, we probably don't even know that number, but maybe if we just could see that there were fees being paid locally, just a side-by-side, anything like that?
Ms. Adrian?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, we have some that are kind of in different locations, but I can compile a list, if that would be helpful, of particularly of federal and county amounts and if there are fees or private funds that go to certain programs.
Thank you. That would be extremely helpful for those of us who are fresh.
Oh, good question. And do you sit on Health and Human Services Finance?
I do not.
Oh, that was asked there, and they said it was something like 85 pages long. And so it's sometimes it's complicated, and I'll tell you, even for us who have been here a while, it's complex, so it's good that we're all taking a look at that, because I think sometimes we could be doing a better job with some of the federal funds and things like that especially. Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. I'm just looking through this updated health research one, and it's talking about the lead abatement program, but I didn't see that on the spreadsheet. Is that somehow, did I miss it, or?
Ms. Adrian?
Madam Chair and Representative Greiling, I believe we no longer have the lead abatement program. The way it was before, and I might be misremembering this, but we had the funding in this committee, and then I think it would be appropriated to your, to the, not to your committee, but to the Department of Education, and maybe they can. It was a really strange thing, how it, but we sort of fixed it, and I believe it's out of our committee now. So I'll follow up on that and make sure.
Okay. Well, we'll follow up, or if it's the department, you welcome to the committee.
Hi, Chair and members. My name is Karen Crossman. I'm the Early Learning Services Director at the Department of Education. And actually, the Lead Abatement Program was transferred to the Department of Health.
Okay.
And
I think, would it be Representative Clark's committee, maybe? I don't know if any of you sit on that. I think it's in that committee.
Yeah.
But we'll make sure and get back to you. If you ever have questions, I mean, where these accounts shuffle around from one term to another. So we, if you do see something missing or if you have questions, make sure you let us know. The other thing I did want to mention is, when we talk about economic downturns, some of us were on the committee in 2003. Were you on there, Representative Nornes, I think? And since 2003, we have done over $250 million has been cut from child care between 2004 and 2007. So when we're looking for cuts, I know we have to look everywhere, but believe me, this area has been cut a lot, and the funds have not been restored. We did in child care, in ECFE, school readiness, and Head Start, we just restored the cuts that we made in 2003. So as we're going through this, we're going to have these deliberations, but I hope we can keep an eye on the investments, and for our youngest kids, if we continue to not fund things like child care and have waiting lists, we're again going to, you know, increase the cost potentially of special education, remedial work, juvenile justice, those types of things. So I think we're going to have to take a hard look. We all are, in all of our committees. But realizing there's quite a history here of what has happened. Ms. Carlson, so you have to answer the two questions as well.
Uh-huh. Oh,
so
question.
Let's see.
Minnetonka, although it was called Hopkins, then the border and the photographs look like I spent a lot of time in the mud and sand and water as well. So it's a three-year-old activity. I think I can even find it on a kindergarten assessment inventory. Children who play in dirt grow up to be bureaucrats and legislators.
You want to tell us how you fit into the things over at MDE and so forth, too? I know. And this is probably because I teach the class, but they have an excellent website. So also, if you need to know anything about MDE, a lot of it's on the website, and you can look it up there. But you've been the director for how long? And tell us a little bit.
I don't know. I think I was older than three, but
it's been a while.
The way that we're structured is we have sort of offices, and I'm in the Office of Academic Excellence, and then we have divisions. The office is headed by an assistant commissioner, and the divisions have division directors, and the division is Early Learning Services. We used to be called Early Childhood or something like that. I don't know. We changed our name.
Can you pull the mic up a little bit closer so we can hear you? Okay, good.
And I'm going to just, like, do a level of detail below what Danielle went through. And I think you have your budget book,
correct?
I'm just going to go through the budget pages. That's where probably the best detail is. And certainly feel free to ask any questions along the way. If you look on page 212, you have the seven programs that actually are on Ms. Adrian's first clump of programs. They're on his spreadsheet. The first one on page 214 is Early Childhood Family Education, ECFE. If you ask people on the street what they know about early childhood programs, ECFE is most often their answer. It does just what it was designed to do. It creates a good child development, parenting, and child activity program for infant, toddlers, and preschoolers. Very neighborhood, school-based. New parents, particularly, gravitate to ECFE. And it has a rather consistent format where the parents and children are together in the first hour of
the class, and in the second hour, the parents go off to a parent education discussion group, and the children are in what we would see as an early childhood classroom. So all school districts sponsor it. There's, you know, it varies on the number of classes, but every school district offers it. And you'll see that it has a lot of history. It was piloted in 1974, and then we had a period of what? It was a long pilot. It was about a decade pilot. And we started calling it demonstration programs after a while because pilot was a little outdated as a word. But in 1984, then, any school district that had a community education program was permitted to offer ECSE, and that pilot remains today. The funding is on 215. We have a little background on the funding. The total revenue is, as Ms. Lemire said, it's funded with state aid and local levies and parent fees. And you'll see in that second paragraph under funding that the aid and the levy comprise 87% of the total revenue. The remaining 13% is primarily by parent fees, but some districts also get private grants to add to their revenue. If anybody has questions, well, we can move on to the school readiness program, which is talked about on page 217. School readiness also runs through the school district. Every school district has it. The program, as you heard, the purpose is to get kids ready for kindergarten, and we put that purpose expressly in the statute just a few years ago. So it's pretty clear what the program is supposed to do. Kids 3 years old to kindergarten entrance can participate. There's $10 million, and as Chair Swalwick said, the restoration of funds occurred just last budget session. Even though there is $10 million, some districts do not get very much money. And so you'll see under the services provided some kind of interesting model. Typically, we would like to be offering in all the school districts an early childhood program that parents can bring the children to and children stay for 2-3 hours a day. A lot of districts can't afford to do that with the school readiness money only. Many districts cobble together different funding sources and are able to offer that. But you'll see that other models, some districts add like 1 or 2 days of child activities to their ECSE schedule. So, and that's their school readiness program. The districts are permitted to contract out services, and so particularly in Greater Minnesota, you'll see this, where districts will use their funds to pay tuition for children to go to community private preschools. So that's a good way of stretching the money, too. You can see on the funding page there on 218, I'm just trying to give you a little idea of, it's not funded at a per child cost, so I do this great mathematics problem, and I take the total amount expended and I divide it by the participants, and that's what I get to tell you about, is $162 per year per participant. So it's kind of tough to do it on that amount of money. And you'll see that Minneapolis and St. Paul obviously get the largest amount of school readiness money, still less than, you know, $900,000. So kind of interesting. If any of you know where Cyrus School District is, they get a whole $732 for a whole year. You can see, though, that the kind of contrasted to ECSE, that the aid that you appropriate is only 59% of the total revenue of this program, meaning that the 41% that remains is from parent fees, so, or private grants. Next program is, well, it isn't really a program, it's a thing we do.
Oh, I think Representative Bly has a question. I just want to let the members know real quick here, too. We have two other
testifiers, we're going to try to end right at 6, and they need about 10 minutes each. So you have about 10 minutes left. Representative Bryan?
Maybe more of a comment, a question, but you can respond. Chair and testifier, a couple of times it's been mentioned the restoration of funds, and when I was preparing that bill, I heard from many of the providers that even though funds were being restored, it wasn't going to bring them up to the level of need that they had. So I didn't want to leave the impression that restoring funds got us back to where we needed to be.
Madam Chair and Representative Bly, I have an excellent comment. And school districts for both the programs that I've talked about maintain waiting lists and have waiting lists. And I'll go tell you about the Head Start waiting list is typically 30% of the enrollment. They have 30% again on their waiting list. So, yeah, nobody is being able to serve everybody. The kindergarten entrance assessment, I can talk more about that at a later hearing if you'd like to see it. There's on our website, there is the report. This is the fifth year we've done it. It's a representative sample of incoming kindergartners within the first 6 weeks of kindergarten. Teachers observe against a checklist, and the checklist contains indicators that four-year-olds should be able to master. So it's sort of a little gauge at whether kids come to school kind of ready for kindergarten, if you will. Next one, health and development screening.
Ms. Carlson, I just want to let the members know we are actually kind of studying a lot of these areas. School readiness, I know Representative Peterson's working on a bill in that area, and assessments we are working on, just like some of the youth that sit on the policy committees related to education. If you're interested in working on assessment, we won't go into all that right now, but we're probably going to be forming some kind of a group on that. So, thank you. Go ahead.
Next one is screening, and as was said earlier, this is a once before school entrance, a child it's a mandatory screening that the child must have. Child doesn't have to have it through the school district. Child can have it through their own private health care provider or another public provider. But there are required components that have to be screened for, and you'll see that in the services provided. You have to have a developmental assessment, a hearing and vision screening, a review of immunization, child height and weight, and identification of risk factors. And then, in addition, the district can offer optional components if they so choose. Like this is an old program, too, established in 1977. We have done some things recently with this program, trying to target children between ages of 3 and 4 to get the screening so the parents don't wait until right before kindergarten, I have to do this, so that if children are identified at needing some extra help, they can get that in the early childhood years before they get to kindergarten. One of the ways we've tried to get at this is to tier the reimbursement amounts, and you'll see that the highest reimbursement rate to a district is for a child screened at age 3, and then it gets less as the older the child gets. So. Next one is Head Start. You probably all have heard about Head Start. That's a really old program, 1965, War on Poverty program. In 1988, the state legislature decided to supplement with state funds some Head Start slots for children. So that's your history here. Currently, there's $85 million of federal money that goes to 36 Head Start programs in Minnesota. That money goes directly from the federal government to the individual 36 programs. Doesn't pass, doesn't stop at us. We administer the $20.1 million of supplemental state funds. And you can see there's about 15% of the total enrollment of children are served by with the state funds. There are income guidelines that a family must meet. Federally, this program was just reauthorized in December of last year, in December of 2007. I still think it's 2008. I'm trying to get with it here. But in December of 2007, it was reauthorized. And
this is where they have waiting lists of about 30% of the kids. The number of kids with disabilities, about 13% of the total enrollment. English language learners, about 27% of total enrollment. So you can see that it is a it targets low-income and at-risk children. Fast here. The program on page 229, Infants and Toddlers Early Intervention, is a totally federal program. You may have heard in special education we talk in letters, so there's Part B and there's Part C. Part B is for children ages 3 through 21, and Part C is for infants and toddlers, and we administer that program in collaboration with the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, because these are really little kids, and most services for those children are family services that take place either in their own homes or in their in an early childhood setting that they wouldn't go to, such as a family childcare home or a childcare center. There's no state money per se with this account, however, there's special education funding that's in Representative Garland's committee that you'll learn about if you're in that committee. And the final program in this clump, I believe, is the Educate Parents Partnership, which is really, I'm not sure how we got that title here from. But we have a website, which is really great. This is not the department website. This is, the website is in the paragraph on services provided. It's mnparentsknow.info. And check it out. It's really good. Started as a focus on newborns, but we've gone way beyond that. So we even have some kindergarten transition things on that website. And you'll see the strategies are, it's not just kind of a static website to look at. We have, you can do customized Google searches. There's videos. There's 75 little videos of child development. There's podcasts. We're really trying to get to new parents that are young and are attached to technology in a way that some of us old folks weren't. So check it out. It's really, it's pretty good. And the department's working on kind of adding on through the older children too, so we're starting to work on that. I think that's about enough.
Well, I think what we'll need to do is, if there aren't any questions, we have two more testifiers in different departments or different areas. But Ms. Carlson, you will get to know her. She will be around.
Here.
Yes. So if you need her, thank you. And next we have Barry Schaefer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Barry Schaefer. I'm the State Director of Adult Basic Education at the Minnesota Department of Education. You have two budget sheets for adult basic education. They begin on page 247, and the other one's on 251. One's a $40 million program. That's the Adult Basic Education General Program. The other one's a much smaller program called GED Test. And that's $125,000 per year. That is a subsidy for providing GED testing services around the state. I really want to spend my time here with the major program, the Adult Basic Education Program, that's on page 247. And specifically, I had copies made of a fact sheet for Adult Basic Education that you have in your packet. It's a front and back with the department's logo on the front, with the ABE logo as well. I just wanted to share some facts about the program. They're also in the budget. Most of this information is in the budget, but I want to highlight a couple of things. Danielle said with the program introduction, the student's eligibility for adult basic education is you must be 16 and over, not enrolled in public school, functioning below the 12th grade level in basic core areas, reading, math, speaking, listening, and speaking English in particular. There are 53 adult basic education programs. We call them consortia around the state. I know many of you have been out to your local consortia speaking and attending graduation ceremonies and that sort of thing. So you're probably familiar with those. So we've aggregated services around 53 cooperative units. It's a locally developed system. It's not a state-mandated kind of map that we've addressed. And membership changes from time to time. Most of the members are public school districts, but there's also, especially in the metro area, community-based organizations and other partners like colleges, workforce centers, etc. We have over 500 delivery sites actually providing adult basic education services throughout the state, about 1,200 licensed instructors, three-quarters of which are part-time instructors because of the nature of schedules for adults attending our programs, and over 3,000 volunteers a year participate in delivering adult basic education. The core programs, and I especially for, I know I think it's three first-time representatives here today, and some of you also are new to this committee. I remember being asked once that, adult basic education, it's those GED folks. Well, yes, it is. That's about 15% of our business in adult basic education is GED. We also do adult diploma. And if an adult comes to us out of school and is only missing a few credits, it makes more sense for them to go an adult diploma route, which means they get the diploma from the school district that they were working at originally, because it's much quicker and gets them out the door quicker. And believe me, adults are not in our programs to stay in. They're in to get what they need and move along quickly into other goals they have in life. So we do GED, adult diploma. We do English as a Second Language. That's a sub-program within Adult Basic Education. That's our largest program, as you might imagine. 45% of our clients are in ESL. It dominates the instructional hours, which is the pay criteria. Instructional hours result in monies for programs, so really ESL students stay longer, work longer in our programs, and need the services longer to move ahead with their English and their other goals in life. I have on that fact sheet three initiatives and priority areas, and this is what I really wanted to get to talk about today, just ever so briefly, just to let you know the impact adult basic education is having and hoping to have in the future on the economic climate of this state. We've been for the last 3 years promoting two of the three initiatives. The first one is transition to employment and workforce education, where adult basic education centers are really concentrating on the employment needs of adults who have low literacy skills. And almost 90% or more of our 75,000 adults a year who come to our services are low-skill and low-wage individuals. Most of them are already working in multiple jobs with very part-time work often, and our programs are directing them to higher employment through increasing their basic skills and literacy needs. We do pre-employment work, not only at the ABE site, but in cooperation with workforce centers around the state and our state college systems. We're co-located in several colleges around the state. And we also do workforce education, which means the adult basic education program works with a local employer, often a large employer like Golden Plump and Schwann's and Marvin Windows and a number of major employers around Minnesota. And most of the work we do in employment sites are ESL work in the context, learning English in the context of that work, of that job. So that's going on with the employment arena as we speak. The second priority we have and initiative is transition to post-secondary and training. And I don't know if you've heard of just a landmark study done in Washington State, which is a state very similar to us in demographics. I call it the tipping point study that showed that what does it take for a person who is low-skill, low-wage to finally make it in terms of self-sufficiency, earning a livable wage. And the answer to that, after studying 10,000 adults who went through from the adult basic ed stage all the way through college and or wherever they went, studying 10,000 folks, they found that the tipping point was 1 year of post-secondary education or training, so college of some kind, plus a certificate. And that usually meant an occupational certificate of some kind. That was getting folks at the tipping point. ABE has taken that study in Minnesota and in many other states, actually, and said, this is the landmark study, this is what we need to be working towards in ABE, getting folks prepared for entering and success in that post-secondary experience so they can get that one, at least 1 year college preparation plus a certificate. So we're gearing up in our transitions effort, working with all the MinSCU campuses across the state in a very collaborative way to set up career pathway programs that blend adult-based education with post-secondary training. So that's the second initiative. And the final one is distance learning. We've just stepped into that arena. K-12's been doing it for a little while, but we now have a GED online program through the Internet where adults who do not have their GED can participate in preparation classes through our ABE centers and learn online and get prepared to take the GED test. Still can't take the GED test online. That's still highly secure, but you can prepare for and take practice tests online. And then finally, with the various information I have on the fact sheet, I think I'll just highlight a couple of things. One is the at the bottom 2008 selected outcome results. I want you to know that our system has met all of its performance targets. We get federal money too, and that comes with pages and pages of requirements and accountability systems, etc. And ever since that started, Adult Basic Education in Minnesota has met all of its performance criteria, which is performance of clients, not performance of the Department of Education, but it's performance moving learners ahead with various learner gains and other outcomes. We delivered about 6,000 GEDs last year. Some other statistics on there on the back page. I heard a question earlier about different kinds of funding that come to the table with regards to programming. On the back, we have we had state aid last year of $41 million. Our federal aid is pretty consistent at $6.8 million and has been. We're in the Workforce Investment Act through the federal government's Department of Education funding. And then we do whatever we can to enhance that with other funds. And last year we had $1.8 million in other funds we got from foundations, the Joyce Foundation, Bush Foundation, and from other agencies like the refugees, federal funding at the Department of Human Services. Finally, I wanted to make sure you had at your fingertips some return on investment concepts and data from our programming. I think the one that always impresses me is the GED concept, that if we can provide a GED, help an adult get their GED, research has shown that that gives them an income boost each year from about $7,000 to $10,000 more than if they would have remained a dropout. And that accumulates over time. That's a very nice return on investment in terms of the money they. It's an economic advantage for them and for the state for them to get their GED. I do have a set of literacy needs and facts about adult-based education program. We are a very literate state, but unfortunately we do have about 10% of our adult population not having high school equivalency. And again, tying it back into the workforce arena, the individuals that are coming to us in adult basic ed, especially our ESL individuals, the how many thousand did we have last year? 32,000 last year, and then our other kinds of folks are the same individuals that really must must take advantage of our service, use our service in order to get that job, get that increased training that they really need to be a productive citizen in the state. We think we're on the right track with that kind of concept, and we're seeing a lot of results around the state with increasing programming around the workforce arena. So that's the picture.
You ended right on time. That was perfect.
Good. There you go.
Briefly, you forgot to tell us, you know, where you lived when you were three. And
Hummelstown, Pennsylvania, which is a suburb of Hershey. You can smell the chocolate. It doesn't smell good when it's cooking, by the way. favorite game is anything to do with wildlife. hunting, fishing, whatever. So.
Good. Well, thank you. And just so the members know, we will have more on ABE. We'll probably have some ABE recipients come in. Sometimes if we do field trips, we haven't talked about field trips because with the deficit and everything. Although this committee, there's an ABE site not very far that sometimes we can go meet there for a committee meeting. And that gives us more exposure to ABE and seeing it from a first-hand experience. So we'll let you know if we're going to be scheduling that. So good. Well, last but not least, question?
Madam Chair, just to make a real quick comment. A friend of mine who was in his middle-aged guy, I guess, applied for a job in my community with a large bakery. And they discovered he didn't have a high school diploma or a GED. So he couldn't get a job. And I guess what it told me is that people do check. Employers do check. And he did go to work and get his GED.
Oh.
Well, so he's employed, and it worked out. But we take it for granted, especially in some of the small communities, that nobody's going to check your resume. They do.
And it makes a difference.
And it makes a difference.
Well, I always remember going with a poverty commission, which Representative Mariani chaired, and we went to Pelican Rapids, which is also in your district, and the factory workers, the turkey factory, and the... I mean, it is amazing. You know, we like to... There's this... being a member and being in the legislature, you get exposed to the whole state, and there's a lot of people out there that don't have that high school education. And
but it's the key.
You know, yeah, it's the key to success and moving ahead and making a living for their families. Well, welcome to the committee, Mr. Let's see, Smith, right?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dan Smith. I'm actually supervisor in the Center for Post-Secondary Success at the department. I apologize, I'm dealing with a little bit of laryngitis, and so I'll try to bear with this and hope I don't get pounded with questions. I'm here to talk a little bit about community education, which has its linkages to the Center for Post-Secondary Success, I think primarily because our center does work with service learning as some of its programming, and also because of some connections with some of the programs to programming in the technical colleges. I want to say that community education in the state is a very heavily utilized program and probably very loosely monitored. The reporting I have, we're still amassing the data that came in from the 2008 year, but from 2007, the district reported 2.9 million individuals participating in community education. That is a duplicated count. So if an individual participated in multiple programs, they would show up many times in that number. And it also does not include numbers that would have been reported separately to the department through adult basic education or early childhood education programs. Each district in the state operates a community education program, and of those, each is required to have a licensed community education director, except for those 56 smallest districts with a population of fewer than 2,000 people. Any waivers to that requirement run through the Minnesota Board of School Administrators. Each district operating a program also must have a community education advisory council to advise the school board on the programming and the cost of the programming, though certainly the school board maintains the control of the funds. Revenue in community education may be for quite a wide variety of things. On the white page that I asked the page to hand out, it's numbered 1 through 8 on the front. And the emphasis varies quite dramatically from one district to another. Some districts may put much of their programming in youth athletics. Other districts have very extensive programming for adults. The general community education revenue may not be used to subsidize the costs of adult enrichment programs. So if you look at the funding for community education, and I'm seeing that I have an error on my own numbers on the back of the page that I have to check out, but of the amount that comes in aid of from your own spreadsheet, about $1.3 million, that's matched by about $21 million in a local levy, and the district's report over $80 million that they would have generated from other fees and other revenue into the program. Some districts in the state operate programs in adults with disabilities. You'll see that as a separate sheet in your budget documents. because it is funded separately, though there's been little change in the districts that are accessing those funds for about the last 6 or 7 years. The funding for adults with disabilities programs, there is an aid of up to half of the cost of the program to a maximum of $30,000. It is my understanding, and much of this happened before I had any involvement with community education from the department, but it's my understanding that early on there were a number of districts that essentially maxed out the aid that was available, and they are the districts that are continuing in that effort. Districts may also elect to operate programs of youth development and youth service, and if they opt to do so, they can access an additional $1 in revenue times the population of the district, or 1,335, whichever is greater. And districts may also opt to offer youth after-school enrichment programs, and there is an aid or a revenue stream connected with that as well. In a nutshell, community education programs, as I say, serve a great number of participants throughout the state. The department's role has been to collect information from school districts, but not provide a great deal of monitoring. We haven't had staff in the department assigned to community education for at least 5 or 6 years. So we collect some data, and actually we share most of our data back with the Community Education Association so that they promote program improvement and program growth that way. I also handed out a short green sheet. There is a program out of community education called Hearing Impaired Educational Support Services. $70,000 is appropriated annually to support the costs of sign language interpreters and note takers for adults participating in educational programs through local school districts, technical colleges, or private or public community agencies. The department collects requests to access these funds throughout the year and makes one distribution at the end of the year, prorating as necessary so that we do not exceed the appropriation. And last year there were about $82,000 in requests and prorated at 84% on the distribution. The intent of these funds is to help in unanticipated costs on the assumption that districts will be if they have a history of supporting many individuals who need sign language interpretation or note-taking services, they would build that into their budget. So that's a very brief overview of community education. I can take questions now or at a future date if you choose.
Well, I think we'll have to do your thing about where you lived when you were three and tell us your favorite game, and then I think we'll kind of wrap up and know that the members can contact you unless there's burning questions.
And thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I meant to start with that, and I'm pleased that you didn't let Mr. Schaefer or Dr. Schaefer leave without making such a statement, too. But I am a local. I was born and raised in Minneapolis, the youngest of five children, and so most of my early memories are being chased around the yard and in the park across the street.
Well, good. Well, thank you. Members, on Thursday we will have an overview by Department of Human Services. So it'll be about child care and those programs. And then there is a debate, Chair Mariani, about January 20th and what to do on that day, whether we're going to have members here or not, with Martin Luther King being a holiday and the inauguration being the 20th. Chair took a poll, and we would like to have committee. So if that's a problem, can you let me know if for some reason you wouldn't be available? But what we would do that day, it would be a little bit of a lighter committee, and that we would have the advocates come and talk about they probably don't think it's lighter. They would like you here if you can be here. If we get a bunch of you that are leaving town, let me know. But I think it's important that we move forward and keep meeting. So we will see you Thursday, and then that would be Tuesday. Chair Mariani.
Can we read the committee?
Yes. Unless you did, you want to, if you want to study it, I suppose you could, as long as you bring it back. But those will be the permanent as we get the new change pages and everything. So, good point. Good. Well, thank you. Have a good night.